You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Rates of sexual abuse and harassment in academic science are second only to the military. It's estimated that at least half of women faculty and staff face harassment and abuse, and that 20 to 50% of women students in science, engineering, and medicine are abused by faculty. Those numbers are generally based on surveys, which are an important way of getting a handle on how pervasive the problem is, understanding how many women are affected and how it changes their career trajectories. But when it comes to holding institutions accountable and creating meaningful cultural and policy changes, naming perpetrators may be even more powerful. My next guest has compiled a list of some 700 investigations of sexual misconduct in academia. She has made that database publicly available, and it is sparking specific calls for funding agencies and professional organizations to stop supporting and promoting sexual abusers. Julie Labarkin is a professor at Michigan State University, where she heads the Geocognition Research Laboratory, and she's behind the Academic Sexual Misconduct Database, which you can now find with a quick internet search. Julie, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sexual abuse is not your usual research area. You're usually investigating how people think about the planet and how that influences our decisions in the environmental realm, things like that. What made you feel that you needed to dedicate your time, a fair bit of your time over the past couple of years, to compiling a list of possible sexual abusers in academia?
Good question. People ask me that question often. I think there were two motivations. One, as a woman in academia, I've experienced my fair share of sexual harassment and abuse, and I know many colleagues who have also. In addition, I got frustrated with the media, to be honest. A couple years ago, there was an article about, I think it was a professor at Chicago, that talked about how this case of a professor being moved from institution to institution was unusual. And I knew it wasn't. And so I decided to just do labor to determine whether or not it was unusual. And it turns out it's not. At least in terms of the cases that I can find. I find several cases every week. And so I wanted to make what was hidden, I think, a lot more explicit.
I want to come back to a couple of points you just made there, but I think we need to step back first and talk about what's actually in the database and how you do find it. And you say this is a database of evidenced investigations. What does that actually mean?
So I actually include in the database a tab that explains how I do the searching. So evidenced means that there is an institutional finding of some sort of sexual misconduct.
So these are essentially completed investigations.
Completed investigations where there's a finding. There may be incomplete investigations that were stopped when a accused left an institution. So often when an accused resigns or retires, an institution will stop the investigation. And so I simply include that in there as well. I don't say that anyone is, quote unquote, guilty of these actions. I simply document what's available through media reports and or legal documents. Again, often these cases are hidden when an institution or an individual settles a case and there's a non-disclosure agreement attached to that settlement. So I include those as well.
So media reports, obviously, you can probably set up an automated search that just kind of notifies you when there's a new media report about a sexual misconduct finding or investigation.
No.
No? That you can't?
No.
Okay. So,
no.
So how do you go about finding either these media reports or especially with the case of the legal documents? The amount of search time involved in this must be huge.
It is. I spend several hours every week doing the searching. And the reason I can't set up an automated system, I could for sexual misconduct or sexual harassment. But the problem is that a lot of times these reports don't use that language. So they might use the language of inappropriate relationship. They might use the language of peeping or voyeurism. They might use the language of rape or murder. And they might use other language that sort of hides the underlying sexual misconduct that's occurring. And so I have a whole set of search terms that I have to use in order to uncover most of these. And in fact, yesterday I found a case from, I think it was 2013, that I hadn't found before. Yeah, 2013, that I hadn't seen before, that I happened to search and I happened to be able to find.
And you mentioned this issue that was one of your motivators of trying to figure out mm-hmm. how pervasive the issue is, mm-hmm. very similar to what we've heard about with the Catholic Church and their sex abuse, clergy sex abuse and cover-up scandal with, in this case, in the academic science case, professors moving from institution to institution. Maybe an investigation is opened and they leave the institution before it's completed. How has that phenomenon reared its head in the data that you've collected over the past couple of years?
Okay, so there's two things. You can use the database to determine what percentage of people in the database have resigned or retired after or during a sexual misconduct investigation or accusation. So it's very pervasive. It occurs in the database. And I haven't looked recently, but when I had about 500 cases, it was a good 30% of the time.
Wow.
The problem is that this database is incomplete. So it is only the cases that are in the public realm in some way. And unfortunately, I can't include cases where there's someone says it happened. I can't include those because I've been threatened with lawsuits and I don't want to be sued. I'm only going to include these evidences, and it's just, I explain very clearly what I mean by evidence. The other point I'd like to make is that when media sources do Freedom of Information Act requests and then make the documents that they find available or summarize those documents, the number of cases in the database leaps. So, for example, the California system, there was a Freedom of Information Act request, and I think there were 30 new cases that I was able to put in the database simply because that information was made available publicly.
All right. I want to go back to this idea of finding people in your database who resigned or retired, mm-hmm. left their institution before there was a completed investigation.
Sure.
Presumably, they pop up again in your database with another investigation at another institution if the idea is that these people are moving from institution to institution and are serial perpetrators.
Some of them do, for sure. Some of them, like Jason Lieb is a classic example, the only way that we found out about the potential that this misconduct had occurred at other institutions was because there was an investigation and finding in Chicago. Apparently, there were two or three institutions before that where there had been some investigation and he had left, but there's no public record of that. And so he appears once.
Why make this database public? I mean, you've already mentioned that you are worried about liability and legal issues by putting this mm-hmm. information out there, that you've had the possibility of legal action raised. So why make this available publicly? I mean, it's a Google Doc on the web that anybody can get to and anybody can download.
Yep, that's right. I would like people to be able to search for individuals. I think one of the biggest problems with sexual misconduct, I imagine anywhere, but certainly in academia, is that there's no way to know if you've experienced harassment or other misconduct, if anyone experienced that before you, right? So there's really no way to find out this information. And so I want people to be able to look at these names. In addition, there are a couple of recent, there's one recent and then one egregious case of people who were found to have engaged in sexual harassment or misconduct. They left an institution. They were hired by a second institution. They engaged in sexual harassment and misconduct. And then they still went on to hold leadership positions, for example. There's one person in particular who, after these two findings, or after he left his two institutions, was elected president of his national society. That's horrific. There are other cases of institutions rehiring people after they were let go or after they left because of sexual misconduct. And there's the very recent case of Simmons at Yale, who had a sexual harassment finding, and then 4 years later, this just happened, was offered an endowed position.
You are part of one petition called Time's Up NIH, specifically mm-hmm. asking the National Institutes of Health to revoke funding to professors, to faculty members who have been found guilty of sexual abuse and harassment. There are some others out there, calls for the American Association for the Advancement of Science to, mm-hmm. And they're considering revoking fellowships, right. prestigious fellowships that have gone to people. I mean, how powerful do you think it is to have this list of names that can really focus some of these efforts toward cultural change and very specific accountability actions?
So I think it can be incredibly powerful. I'm a scientist. I like data. So, of course, my first approach to tackling this issue was to collect data, right? And I enjoy it. I think it's quite powerful. And one of the initiatives that we have with this database, I'm collaborating with a colleague. It's a brand new collaboration at Wayne State. We are going to work with our students to try to collect some additional data out of these cases. And one of the things that I've started doing that I hope the students will help with is identifying major honors and awards that these individuals hold, as well as leadership positions that they acquired after the finding. Because I think that, as some of my colleagues have taught me, this sort of issue in academia, much of it is about power. And so it's power-based harassment. And it's very important to ensure that people who have engaged in this form of misconduct are not allowed to have positions of power where they get to have some say over another person's career.
That power structure exists everywhere in academic science because it's essentially an apprenticeship system. But I was particularly shocked just glancing through the database to see that a handful of the cases in that database involved people who were diversity officers. Their job was diversity and inclusion, which, you know, where could you have a worse mismatch, right? I wonder what has surprised you in looking through the database over the past couple of years.
So the biggest surprise for me was the man who hired a hitman to kill the woman who accused him of sexual misconduct. That was, I think, perhaps the biggest. He was caught before the hitman was hired, but that was extremely surprising. I'm also surprised that gender studies faculty engage in these behaviors. I'm not surprised that the behavior is somewhat independent of gender. The vast majority of the cases are men harassing women. Those are the cases we hear about. But there are plenty of cases in the database, or a handful, of women harassing men, or women harassing women, or men harassing men. I'm also surprised that people aren't fired. It's interesting, when I do the searches, I find all sorts of faculty who've engaged in illegal behaviors that do get them fired. So there's a professor who the university fired because he flashed someone not on campus. And then there was a lawsuit and they actually had to reinstate him. But when those behaviors, or much worse behaviors, at least for individuals, occur on campus, it seems as if institutions are often willing to turn a blind eye, particularly when they perceive the accused as someone who is, quote unquote, beneficial to their reputations. I'm also surprised at how institutions, certainly in the past, were unable to act to protect students or junior faculty. So there are multiple cases of people who murdered the people that they were harassing eventually. And it was eventually. There was background.
I think broadly, not just within the sciences, but with the start of the Me Too movement a year ago and Time's Up, that there have been two kind of camps, and I think you can actually sit in both of them at the same time. In some cases, it feels like the pace of change, the pace of at least increase in awareness and discussion about issues of sexual abuse and harassment has been incredibly fast. And then on the other hand, this lingering frustration that things just cannot change enough fast enough. Do you feel like the science community is responding as quickly as it can, as quickly as it should, to try to correct the problems within the system?
So I don't think there is one monolithic science community. I think that there are sub-communities. So some organizations, I'll shout out to one of mine, the American Geophysical Union, have responded eloquently and rapidly to the issue of sexual misconduct at professional meetings. And they have what many people consider one of the best policies out there. And they're always willing to discuss it and change. So that's fabulous. I think other organizations, the National Academy of Science, for example, are slower to change. And part of it is because of a sense that there's an existing structure for how change occurs, and they need to follow that structure. I'm of the school of thought that we should destroy our structures, that our structures are inherently racist, sexist, ableist, et cetera, and that destroying them and trying to build something anew would be wonderful. I think this about many different kinds of structures. So there's that. At the same time, I was surprised a couple of years ago. I was having a conversation with a male colleague who is an excellent leader at my institution. I value him very much. And he was flabbergasted to hear about all of the sexual harassment, et cetera, that I've experienced from words to physical assault. And he said, but it's 2016. I didn't think this stuff happened anymore. And the point of that is that I don't think that many of my colleagues are even aware of what their colleagues, male or female, may or other, may be experiencing, because they don't experience and they don't see it and they don't talk about it. So the Me Too movement started, you know, a few years ago, the Time's Up movement, et cetera, is simply, I think, allowing people to engage in conversations that may have been very uncomfortable before.
Julie Labarkin is a professor of geocognition at Michigan State University, and she's behind the now publicly available Academic Sexual Misconduct Database. Julie, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Up next, a pro football player turned sociologist turns his eye on the NFL. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.